Chapter 33 Theories of Interest Rate. Page 252. Introduction. This chapter discusses some of the important theories of interest rate, such as the classical, the loanable funds, the Keynesian, and the modern theory of interest. Besides, certain issues like the natural and market rates of interest are also examined. Of the theories discussed below, the Keynesian liquidity preference theory that determines the interest rate by the demand for and supply of money is a stock theory. It emphasizes that the rate of interest is a purely monetary phenomenon. It is a stock analysis because it takes the supply of money as given during the short run and determines the interest rate by liquidity preference or demand for money. On the other hand, the loanable funds theory is a flow theory that determines the interest rate by the demand for and supply of loanable funds. It involves the linking of the interest rate with this saving, investment, and hoarding of funds on the demand side with savings, dishoardings, and bank money on the supply side. These are all flow variables. Hicks and Hansen have reconciled and synthesized these stock and flow theories in a general equilibrium framework and presented a determinate theory of interest rate in terms of ISLM formulation. The classical theory of interest. According to the classical theory, rate of interest is determined by the supply of and demand for capital. The supply of capital is governed by the time preference and the demand for capital by the expected productivity of capital. Both time preference and productivity of capital depend upon waiting or saving or thrift. The theory, therefore, also known as the supply and demand theory of saving. Demand side. The demand for capital consists of the demand for productive and consumptive purposes. Ignoring the latter, capital is demanded by the investors because it is productive. But the productivity of capital is subject to the law of variable proportions. Additional units of capital are not as productive as the earlier units. A stage comes when the employment of an additional unit of capital in the business is just worthwhile and no more. Suppose an investor invests Rs. 1 lakh in a factory and expects a yield of 20%. Another installment of an equal amount would not be as productive as the first one and might bring him 15%, while a third installment might yield 10%. If he has borrowed the money at 10%, he will not venture to invest more, for the rate of interest is just equal to the marginal productivity of capital to him. It shows that at a higher rate of interest, the demand for capital is low and it is high at a lower rate of interest. Thus, the demand for capital is inversely related to the rate of interest, and the demand schedule for capital or investment curve slopes downward from left to right. There are, however, certain other factors which govern the demand for capital, such as the growth of population, technical progress, process of rationalization, the standard of living of the community, etc. Supply side. The supply of capital depends upon savings, rather upon the will to save and the power to save in the community. Some people save irrespective of the rate of interest. They would continue to save even if the rate of interest was zero. There are others who save because the current rate of interest is just enough to induce them to save. They would reduce their savings if the rate of interest fell below this level. Still, there are the potential savers who would be induced to save if the rate of interest were raised. To the last two categories of savers, saving involves a sacrifice, abstinence, or waiting when they forego present consumption in order to earn interest. The higher the rate of interest, the larger will be the community's savings, and more will be the supply of funds. The supply curve of capital or the savings curve thus moves upward to the right. Page 253. Determination. Assuming the level of income to be given, the rate of interest is determined by the interaction of the demand curve and the supply curve of saving. This is shown in figure 1. So in figure 1 we have saving and investment on the x-axis and interest rate on the y-axis. There is a supply curve which is a rising curve as we move towards the right on the x-axis, and the demand curve, which is a falling curve as we move towards the right on the x-axis. Demand curve D and supply curve S intersect at point E, which is the equilibrium point. Corresponding to point E, on the x-axis is point Q, and the interest rate on the y-axis is R. The other points marked on the supply curve S are S and small s and small s1. Corresponding to small s is interest rate is R1, and corresponding to small s1 the interest rate is R2. There are other points marked on the demand curve, which is small d corresponding to R1 and small d1 corresponding to R2. There is another supply curve marked a dotted line capital S1, which is parallel to the S but passing through small d1. So returning to the text. So in this figure, I and S curves intersect at capital E, which is the equilibrium point when OQ quantity of capital is demanded and supplied at capital R rate of interest. If at any point of time the rate of interest rises above R, the demand for investment funds will fall and the supply of savings will increase. Since the supply of savings is more than the demand, that is capital R1 small s is greater than capital R1 d, the rate of interest will come down to the equilibrium level OR. The opposite will be the case if the rate of interest falls to R2. The demand for investment funds is greater than the supply of savings, that is R2 d1 is greater than R2 small s1. The rate of interest will rise to R. The ultimate situation is one of equality between saving and investment brought about by the equilibrium or the natural rate of interest. If at any time people become thrifty and save more than OQ, the rate of interest would fall below R because the demand for capital remains the same. This is shown by the downward shift of the saving curve to S1, where it intersects the I curve at D1 and the rate of interest falls to R2. At the rate of interest, people will save less, but the demand for investment funds will increase, which will tend to raise the rate of interest to the equilibrium level capital R. Its criticisms. The pure and the real theory of interest of the classicals, as enunciated by Marshall and Piaggio, has been severely criticized by Keynes. 1. Income not constant but variable. One of the serious defects of the classical theory is that it assumes the level of income to be given and regards interest as an equilibrating mechanism between the demand for investable funds and the supply of funds through savings. According to Keynes, income is a variable and not a constant, and the equality between saving and investment is brought about by changes in income and not by variations in the rate of interest. 2. Saving investment schedules not independent. In this theory, the two determinants of interest rate, the demand and the supply curves of saving, are treated as independent of one another. It means that if there is change in demand, the demand curve for savings can shift up or below the I curve without causing a change in the supply curve. But according to Keynes, the two curves are not independent of one another. If, for instance, an invention shifts the investment curve upwards, income will rise and it will lead to higher savings and thus shift the supply curve too. Similarly, a shift in the supply curve will bring a change in the demand curve. 3. Neglects the effects of investment on income. The classical theory neglects the effects of investment on the level of income. A rise in the rate of interest, for instance, will bring a decline in investment by making it less profitable. This will mean decline in output, employment, and income. The latter will in turn lead to reduced savings, a fact contrary to the classical assertion that saving is a direct function of the rate of interest. On the other hand, a low rate of interest encourages investment activity, increases output, employment, income, and savings. But Keynes does not believe that investment depends on the rate of interest. It depends on the marginal efficiency of capital. Even if the rate of interest were to fall to zero, Keynes argues, investment will not take place if business expectations for profits are at a low level, as in the case in depression. 4. Intermediate theory. Since savings depend upon the level of income, it is not possible to know the rate of interest unless the income level is known beforehand. And the income level itself cannot be known without already knowing the rate of interest. A lower rate of interest will increase investment, output, employment, income and savings. So, for each income level, a separate saving curve will have to be drawn. This is all circular reasoning and offers no solution to the problem of interest. That is why Keynes characterized the classical theory of interest as indeterminate. Page 254. 5. Neglects other sources of savings. The propounders of this theory include savings out of current income in the supply schedule of savings, which makes it inadequate. Considering the supply of capital to be interest elastic, people might lend their past savings with the rise in the rate of interest and so increase the supply of capital. Similarly, bank credit is an important source of the supply of capital. Banks lend more during periods of slow business activity. The classical theory remains incomplete when it neglects these factors in the supply schedule of capital. 6. Unrealistic assumption of full employment. The classical theory is based on the unrealistic assumption of full employment. In a fully employed economy, interest as a reward for saving, waiting, or abstinence is necessary to induce people to save. But according to Keynes, underemployment and not full employment is the rule, and where resources are unemployed, interest is not essentially an inducement to savings. 7. Neglects monetary factors. The classical theory is a pure or real theory of interest which takes into consideration the real factors like the time preference and the marginal productivity of capital. It completely neglects the influence of monetary factors on the determination of the rate of interest. The classical economists regarded money as a veil, a medium of exchange over goods and services. They failed to consider it as a store of value. Keynes, on the other hand, laid emphasis on explaining the determination of the rate of interest as a monetary phenomenon. 8. No automatic equality between equilibrium and market rates of interest. According to the classical view, the market and the equilibrium, that is, natural rates of interest, are always equal. Any discrepancy between the two is only a temporary phenomena which would disappear in the long run. Keynes, however, does not regard the discrepancy between the two as accidental and temporary. It can be due to the contraction or expansion of bank credit. An expansion of bank credit by increasing the supply of loanable funds brings about a fall in the market rate of interest below the equilibrium rate and vice versa. Thus, there is no automatic mechanism for the equality of market and equilibrium interest rate. 9. Difference over the definition of interest. Keynes differs with the classical economists even over the definition and determination of the rate of interest. According to him, it is the reward of not hoarding, but the reward of parting with liquidity for a specified period. It is the price which equilibrates demand for money with the available quantity of money. He does not agree that it is determined by the demand for and supply of capital. Thus, Keynes dismisses the classical theory of interest as absolutely wrong and inadequate. The loanable funds theory of interest. The neoclassical or the loanable funds theory explains the determination of interest in terms of demand and supply of loanable funds or credit. According to this theory, the rate of interest is the price of credit, which is determined by the demand and supply for loanable funds. In the words of Professor Lerner, it is the price which equates the supply of credit or saving plus the net increase in the amount of money in a period to the demand for credit or investment plus net holding in the period. Let us analyze the forces behind the demand and supply of loanable funds. Demand for loanable funds. The demand for loanable funds has primarily three sources, that is, government, businessmen, and consumers who need them for purposes of investment, hoarding, and consumption. The government borrows funds for constructing public works or for war preparations. The businessmen borrow for the purchase of capital goods and for starting investment projects. Such borrowings are interest elastic and depend mostly on the expected rate of profit as compared with the rate of interest. The demand for loanable funds on the part of consumers is for the purchase of durable consumer goods like scooters, houses, etc. Individual borrowings are also interest elastic. The tendency to borrow is more at a lower rate of interest than at a higher rate in order to enjoy their consumption soon. Since this demand for funds is mostly met out of past savings or through dis-saving, it is represented by the curve DS in figure 2. Figure 2 is a very, very complicated figure, so I will not be able to explain it. The demand curve for investment funds, both for the government and the businessman, is shown as curve I. It slopes downwards, showing that less funds are borrowed at a higher rate and more at a lower rate of interest. Lastly, funds are demanded for the purpose of holding them in liquid form or as idle cash. They are also interest elastic and are shown by the H curve. The lateral summation of these curves, H, DS and I, gives us the aggregate demand curve for loanable funds as summation D. Page 255. Supply of loanable funds. The supply of loanable funds comes from savings, dis-hoardings and bank credit. Private, individual and corporate savings are the main source of savings. Though personal savings depend upon the income level, yet taking the level of income as given, they are regarded as interest elastic. The higher the rate of interest, the greater will be the inducement to save and vice versa. Corporate savings are the undistributed profits of a firm, which also depend on the current rate of interest to some extent. If the interest rate is high, it will act as a deterrent to borrowing and thus encourage savings. Savings are indicated as curve S in the figure 2. The second source is the volume of funds coming out of hoards or being added to them. Dis-hoarding may represent not only purchase of old assets or securities from others out of the idle cash balances of one's own funds for net investment or for consumption in purchases in excess of net disposable income. Such funds are directly related to the rate of interest. The higher the interest rate, the larger the funds that will be coming out of hoards and vice versa. These funds are represented by the curve DH. Lastly, there is the bank credit as an important source of supply of loanable funds. Bank credit or money is also interest elastic to some extent. More funds are lent at a higher rate than at a lower rate of interest. Bank credit is shown as the curve M. If these curves DH, M and S are laterally added up, we have the aggregate supply curve sigma S of loanable funds. The total demand curve for loanable funds, sigma D, and the total supply curve of loanable funds, sigma S, intersect at E and give OR rate of interest. At this rate, OQ amount of funds are borrowed and lent. Its criticisms. According to Professor Robertson, the loanable funds theory is a common sense explanation of the determination of the rate of interest. But this theory is also not free from certain defects. 1. Equilibrium rate reflects unstable equilibrium. The demand and supply schedules for loanable funds determine the equilibrium rate of interest OR, which does not equate each component on the supply side with the corresponding component on the demand side. Thus, the equilibrium rate OR reflects unstable equilibrium. For stable equilibrium, it is essential that ex ante, that is planned investment, must equal ex ante savings at the equilibrium rate OR. In the figure, ex ante savings S exceeds ex ante investment I by AB. They are equal at point E1. But at a lower rate OR1, which is the natural rate of interest. 2. Indeterminate theory. Professor Hansen asserts that the loanable funds theory, like the classical and the Keynesian theories of interest, is indeterminate. The supply curve of loanable funds is composed of savings, dishoardings and bank money. But since savings vary with past income and the new money and activated balances with the current income, it follows that the total supply curve of loanable funds also varies with income. Thus, the loanable funds theory is indeterminate unless the income level is already known. Note 1. A. H. Hansen, A Guide to Keynes, page 141. 3. Cash balances not elastic. The loanable funds theory states that the supply of loanable funds can be increased by releasing cash balances of savings and decreased by absorbing cash balances into savings. This implies that the cash balances are fairly elastic, but this does not seem to be a correct view at any time. But this does not seem to be a correct view because the total cash balances available with the community are fixed and equal the total supply of money at any time. Whenever there are variations in the cash balances, they are in fact in the velocity of circulation of money rather than in the amount of cash balances with the community. 4. Savings not interest elastic. The theory overemphasizes the influence of the rate of interest on savings. It regards savings as interest elastic. Generally speaking, people save not to earn rate of interest but to satisfy precautionary motive. So savings are interest inelastic. 5. Not correct to combine real and monetary factors. The loanable funds theory has been criticized for combining monetary factors with real factors. It is not correct to combine real factors like saving and investment with monetary factors like bank credit and dishoarding without bringing in changes in the level of income. This makes the theory unrealistic. Page 256. Its superiority over the classical theory. Despite these weaknesses, the loanable funds theory is better and more realistic than the classical theory on a number of counts. 1. The classical theory is a real theory of interest and neglects monetary influences on interest. With the inclusion of real as well as monetary factors, the loanable funds theory becomes superior to the classical theory. 2. The classicists neglect the role of bank credit as a constituent of money supply, influencing the rate of interest, which is an important factor in the loanable funds theory. 3. The classicists also do not consider the role of hoarding. By including the desire to hoard money in the demand for loanable funds, the loanable funds theory becomes more realistic and brings us nearer to Keynes's liquidity preference theory. 4. To the classicists, money is merely a veil, a passive factor influencing the rate of interest. The loanable funds theory is superior because it regards money as an active factor in the determination of the interest rate. Keynes's liquidity preference theory of interest. Keynes defines the rate of interest as the reward of not hoarding but the reward for parting with liquidity for a specified period. It is not the price which brings into equilibrium the demand for resources to invest with the readiness to abstain from consumption. It is the price which equilibrates the desire to hold wealth in the form of cash with the available quantity of cash. Note 2. J. M. Keynes, The General Theory of Employment, Interest and Money, page 167. In other words, the rate of interest in the Keynesian sense is determined by the demand for and supply of money. This theory is therefore characterized by the monetary theory of interest as distinct from the real theory of the classicals. Supply of money. Of the two determinants of the rate of interest, the supply of money refers to the total quantity of money in the country for all purposes at any time. Though the supply of money is a function of the rate of interest to a degree, yet it is considered to be fixed by monetary authorities, that is, the supply of money is taken as perfectly inelastic. Demand for money. For the second determinant, the demand for money, Keynes coined a new term, liquidity preference, by which his theory of interest is commonly known. Liquidity preference is the desire to hold cash. The money in cash lulls our disquietude, and the rate of interest which is demanded in exchange for it is a measure of the degree of our disquietude. The rate of interest, in Keynes' words, is a premium which has to be offered to induce people to hold the wealth in some form other than hoarded money. The higher the liquidity preference, the higher will be the rate of interest that will have to be paid to the holders of cash to induce them to part with their liquid assets. The lower the liquidity preference, the lower will be the rate of interest that will be paid to the cash holders. According to Keynes, there are three motives behind the desire of the people to hold liquid cash. 1. The transaction motive. 2. The precautionary motive. And 3. The speculative motive. Transactions motive. The transactions motive relates to the need of cash for current transactions of personal and business exchanges. It is further divided into the income and business motives. The income motive is meant to bridge the interval between the receipt of income and its disbursement. And similarly, the business motive, as the interval between the time of incurring business costs and that of the receipt of the sale proceeds. If the time between the incurring of expenditure and receipt of income is small, less cash will be held by people for current transactions and vice versa. There will, however, be changes in the transactions demand for money depending upon the expectations of the income of recipient and businessman. They depend upon the level of income, employment and prices, business turnover, the normal period between the receipt and disbursement of income, the amount of salary or income, and on the possibility of getting a loan. Page 257. Precautionary motive. The precautionary motive relates to the desire to provide for contingencies requiring sudden expenditures and for unforeseen opportunities of advantageous purchases. Both individuals and businessmen keep cash in reserve to meet unexpected needs. Individuals hold some cash to provide for illness, accidents, unemployment, and other unforeseen contingencies. Similarly, businessmen keep cash in reserve to tide over unfavorable conditions or to gain from unexpected deals. Money held under the precautionary motive is rather like water kept in reserve in a water tank. The precautionary demand for money depends upon the level of income and business activity, opportunities for unexpected profitable deals, availability of cash, the cost of holding liquid assets in bank reserves, etc. Keynes holds that the transactions and precautionary motives are relatively interest inelastic but are highly income elastic. The amount of money held under these two motives, M1, is a function, L1, of the level of the income, Y, and is expressed as M1 is equal to L1 bracket of Y. Speculative motive. Money held under the speculative motive is for securing profit from knowing better than the market what the future will bring forth. Individuals and businessmen have funds after keeping enough for transactions and precautionary purposes and like to gain by investing in bonds. Money held for speculative purposes is a liquid store of value which can be invested at an opportune moment in interest-bearing bonds or securities. Bond prices and the rate of interest are inversely related to each other. Low bond prices are indicative of high interest rates, and high bond prices reflect low interest rates. A bond carries a fixed rate of interest. For instance, if a bond of value of rupees 100 carries 4% interest and the market rate of interest rises to 8%, the value of this bond falls to rupees 50 in the market. If the market rate of interest falls to 2%, the value of the bond will rise to rupees 200 in the market. Thus, individuals and businessmen can gain by buying bonds worth rupees 100 each at the market rate of rupees 50 each when the rate of interest is high, that is 8%, and sell them again when they are dearer, that is rupees 200 each when the rate of interest falls to 2%. According to Keynes, it is expectations about changes in bond prices or in the current market rate of interest that determine the speculative demand for money. The speculative demand for money is a decreasing function of the rate of interest. The higher the rate of interest, the lower the speculative demand for money, and lower the rate of interest, the higher the speculative demand for money. Algebraically, Keynes expressed the speculative demand for money as M2 equal to L2 bracket small r, where L2 is the speculative demand for money and small r is the rate of interest. Geometrically, it is a smooth curve which slopes downwards from left to right as shown in figure 3. So in figure 3 we have amount of money on the x-axis, interest rate on the y-axis. The curve L is a smooth curve which is sloping downwards as we move from the left to the right. There is another curve which is a straight line Q1 which intersects. Q1 is parallel to the y-axis and it intersects the L curve at point E. Corresponding to this, the amount of money is M. There are two other rates of interest. Corresponding to E, the rate of interest is R. If we consider R1 higher than R and R2 lower than R, then corresponding to R1, equilibrium point is E1 on the L curve, and corresponding to R2, the equilibrium point is E2. Corresponding to E1, money is M1. Corresponding to E2, money is M2. Returning to the text. But at a very low rate of interest, such as 2%, the speculative demand for money becomes perfectly elastic. This portion of the curve is known as the liquidity trap. At a very low rate of interest, people prefer to keep money in cash rather than invest in bonds because purchasing bonds will mean a definite loss. Total demand for money. If the total liquid money is denoted by M, the transactions plus precautionary motive by M1 and the speculative motive for holding by M2, then M is equal to M1 plus M2. Since M1 is equal to L bracket capital Y and M2 is equal to L2 bracket small r, the total liquidity preference function is expressed as M is equal to L of within bracket capital Y and small r. M1 is circulating or active money and M2 is idle or passive money. Though M1 is a function of income and M2 of the rate of interest, yet they cannot be held in watertight compartments. Even M1 is interest elastic at high interest rates. If there is increased demand for M1, it can be met by transferring funds from idle balances, M2. Professor Haberler distinguishes between liquidity preference in the narrower sense and liquidity preference in the wider sense. The former is the demand for idle balances, M2, and is called liquidity preference proper, and the latter is the total liquidity demand, M or M1 plus M2. Given the level of income at high interest rates, liquidity preference refers to the total demand for money, M1 plus M2, and at low interest rates, the demand for speculative motive, M2 alone. Determination of rate of interest. We have analyzed the factors behind the supply and demand for money. The rate of interest, like the price of any product or service, is determined at a level where the demand for money equals the available supply of money. Page 258. In figure 3, the vertical line Q1M represents the supply of money and L is the total demand for money curve. Both intersect at E, where the equilibrium rate of interest capital R is established. If there is any deviation from this equilibrium position, an adjustment will take place via the rate of interest and the equilibrium level E is re-established. E1 is the position of unstable equilibrium where the supply of money OM is greater than the demand for money OM1. Consequently, the rate of interest will start declining from R1 till the equilibrium rate of interest R is reached. Similarly, at R2 level of interest rate, the demand for money OM2 is greater than the supply of money OM. As a result, the rate of interest R2 will start rising till it reaches the equilibrium rate R. If the supply of money is increased by the monetary authorities, but the liquidity preference curve L remains the same, the rate of interest will fall. This is illustrated in figure 4. So in figure 4, we have amount of money on the x-axis and interest rate on the y-axis. We have the L curve as previously, which is a downward sloping curve as we move towards the right. Then there are 4 Q curves, Q, Q1, Q2 and Q3, intersecting the L curve at E, E1, E2 and E3 respectively. Corresponding to the money is M, M1, M2, M3. The rate of interest for E is R5. The rate of interest corresponding to E1 is R3. And the rate of interest corresponding to E2 and E3 is R2. Because after E2, E3, the curve nearly becomes parallel to the x-axis. So, going back to the text. Given the L curve, the supply of money curve being QM, the rate of interest is R5. With the increase in the supply of money from QM to Q1, M1 and Q2, M2, the rate of interest falls from R3 to R2. But any further increase in the supply of money has no effect on the rate of interest because the liquidity preference curve L is perfectly elastic at R2 rate of interest. So when the supply of money increases to Q3, M3, the rate of interest remains stationary at R2 corresponding to the equilibrium point E3. This is Keynes's liquidity trap. If the demand for money increases and the liquidity preference curve shifts upwards, given the supply of money, the rate of interest rises. This is shown in figure 5. So in figure 5, we have one curve L, another curve also L, but they are meeting at the same point where they become parallel to the x-axis. One curve is lower than the other, and there are two Q curves, one is QM and the other is Q1, M1, where L intersects the lower L, where it intersects Q is E, and when the higher L intersects Q is E1, where the higher L intersects Q1, M1 is point E2. Corresponding to E1, the interest rate is R6. Corresponding to E or E2, the interest rate is R4. Returning to the text. Given the supply of money curve QM, when the L curve shifts upwards, the new equilibrium point is E1, which determines R6 interest rate. This rate of interest is higher than R4 interest rate at the equilibrium point E. If with the increase in the liquidity preference, the supply of money also increases in the same proportion to Q1, M1, there will be no change in the rate of interest R4, except that the new equilibrium point is E2. Thus, the theory explains that rate of interest is determined at a point where the liquidity preference curve equals the supply of money curve. Its criticisms. The Keynesian theory of interest has been severely criticized by Hansen, Robertson, Knight, Hazlitt, Hutt, and others. It has been variously characterized as a college bursar's theory, at best an inadequate and at worst a misleading account, and pre-classical mercantilist and man-in-the-street economics. 1. College bursar's theory. One of the fallacies of the Keynesian analysis is that the demand for money is mainly associated with the liquidity preference for the speculative motive to which the rate of interest is brought directly into touch. The theory presumes the existence of a number of wealthy and shrewd persons who will hold more money by selling bonds when the rate of interest falls and hold less cash but more bonds in the case of rise in the interest rate. But Robertson does not regard bonds as the only alternative to money as a use for resources both by the individual and the entrepreneur. And a theory of money which insists on working everything through the bond market is a college bursar's theory and seems to be lacking in realism and comprehensiveness. 2. Inadequate and misleading theory. The theory tells us nothing as to what determines the normal rate and therefore, given the degree of divergence, the actual rate of interest. The actual rate of interest cannot be described consistently as measuring the cost of the uncertainty of risk involved in holding bonds rather than money. If there were no uncertainty at all, the actual rate would simply stand at a certain definite level below the normal rate. It is for these reasons that Robertson regards the liquidity preference theory as at best an inadequate and at worst a misleading account. Page 259. 3. Falls into methodological fallacy. Just as the rate of interest is explained as the price for parting with liquidity, similarly, the price of eggs or any other commodity can be explained by the relative preference for them. But there is a vital difference. A change in the quantity of money would tend to change the price of goods in the same proportion, but not the price of bonds beyond a temporary disturbance. In fact, there is no functional relationship between the price level and any rate of interest while discussing the influence of speculation on the interest rate on loans. As a result, no monetary change has any direct or permanent effect on the rate of interest. Thus, the Keynesian theory falls into methodological fallacy by assuming a definite functional relationship between the quantity of money and the rate of interest. 4. Money as a store of wealth is barren. Keynes holds that only money held for speculative purposes is fruitful, for it brings interest as a reward, while money as a store of wealth is barren. This is a mistaken notion. As pointed out by W. H. Hutt, money is as productive as all other assets and productive in exactly the same sense. The demand for money assets is a demand for productive resources. 5. Inconsistent theory. Knight criticized Keynes's theory in view of the facts, which are directly contrary to what the theory calls for. Hazlitt also discusses this point without giving credit to Knight. According to the Keynesian theory, the rate of interest should be the highest at the bottom of the depression because the liquidity preference is the strongest at that time due to falling prices. A large reward will have to be paid to induce wealth holders to part with their cash. But the facts are just the opposite. Short-term interest rates are the lowest in a depression because investment opportunities are temporarily closed and the lenders have no outlets to part with their cash. Contrariwise, the Keynesian short-term interest rates should be lowest during the peak of the boom because people would be investing their money rather than keep it in cash. The liquidity preference being the lowest, a very small reward would be required to partake with it. But in reality, the rate of interest is the highest at the peak of a boom. Thus, the theory is inconsistent with facts. 6. Saving essential for liquidity. Keynes regards the rate of interest as the reward for parting with liquidity and not a return merely for saving or waiting so much. Saving is necessary for obtaining funds to be invested at interest. In Viner's words, without saving, there can be no liquidity to surrender. The rate of interest is the return for saving without liquidity. 7. Liquidity not essential for interest rate. Even the term liquidity preference is neither helpful nor necessary in explaining the nature of interest. It is more confusing and less illuminating. It is not only vague but is also self-contradictory. For as pointed out by Hazlitt, if a man is holding his funds in the form of time deposits or short-term treasury bills, he is being paid interest on them. Therefore, he is getting interest and liquidity too. What becomes, then, of Keynes' theory that interest is the reward for parting with liquidity? 8. Wrong notion of liquidity trap. Keynes's notion of the liquidity trap is also wrong. In reality, the liquidity preference schedule may be perfectly inelastic rather than elastic at a low rate of interest. We know that during a depression, all expectations are extremely pessimistic. It is therefore not correct to argue that expectations with regard to the rate of interest will be that it will go up. 9. Ignores real factors. The greatest fallacy in Keynes's analysis is that he ignores the influence of real factors in determining the interest rate. He regards the interest rate as a purely monetary phenomena and thus merely returns to the pre-classical assumption of the mercantilist and to what has always been the assumption of the man in the street. According to Hazlitt, Keynes made no new contribution. He merely muddled shallow waters, and the kind of interest story represented by him is pre-classical, mercantilistic and man-in-the-street economics. 10. Indeterminate theory. The Keynesian theory, like the classical theory of interest, is indeterminate. Keynes asserts that liquidity preference and quantity of money determine the rate of interest. But this is not correct because a new liquidity preference curve will have to be drawn at each level of income. Therefore, unless the income level is already known, the demand and supply curves of money cannot tell us what the rate of interest will be. Thus, according to Professor Hansen, Keynes' criticism of the classical theory applies equally to his own theory. 11. Incomplete theory. Hicks, Somers, Lerner, Hansen and others opine that the rate of interest along with the level of income is determined by four factors. 1. The investment demand function, MEC. 2. The saving function or the consumption function. 3. The liquidity preference function. And 4. The quantity of money function. Though all these elements are found in the Keynesian analysis, yet Keynes did not bring them in his interest rate theory. He takes only the last two elements and ignores the first two. Thus, Keynes fails to provide an integrated and determinate theory of interest. Page 260. 12. Confusion regarding relation between interest rate and quantity of money. There is confusion in Keynes's analysis about the relation between rate of interest and amount of money. On the one hand, he says that the demand for money is inversely dependent on the rate of interest, and on the other, the equilibrium rate of interest is inversely dependent upon the amount of money. Throughout his analysis, Keynes does not make any distinction between the two propositions and often uses them in an identical manner. This is a fundamental error in Keynes's analysis, for the former relation holds true for an individual and the latter for the market. Conclusion. The Keynesian theory of interest is not only indeterminate, but is also an inadequate explanation of the determination of the rate of interest. It treats the interest rate as a purely monetary phenomena, and by neglecting the real factors, makes the theory narrow and unrealistic. Its superiority over the loanable funds theory. Despite these criticisms of the Keynesian theory, it is considered superior to the loanable funds theory on the following counts. 1. The Keynesian theory is a stock analysis. It is a statement about stocks or quantities of money at a point of time, while the loanable funds theory is a statement about certain flows or quantities of money per time period. It is this treatment of stocks and flows of money that leads to a fixed supply of money in the Keynesian analysis and a variable supply of money in the loanable funds theory. Since the quantity of money is fixed at a point of time, economists prefer the stock approach to the rate of interest. Thus, liquidity preference theory becomes superior to the loanable funds theory. 2. The liquidity preference theory is more realistic than the loanable funds theory because it is more akin to the behavior of interest rate in the business world. It clearly spells out the various motives for holding money and the relation between business expectations and the rate of interest. 3. All the variables in the loanable funds theory like saving, investment, hoarding, dishoarding are in terms of partial equilibrium analysis, while the demand for and supply of money in the Keynesian system have been treated as a part of the general determinant system. So, the loanable funds theory fails to fit in a general determinant system. 4. In the loanable funds theory, saving and investment are redundant and the rate of interest can be determined by H plus DS and M plus DH. whereas in the Keynesian theory, savings are interest inelastic and investment funds depend upon the money supply. The Keynesian theory is thus superior to the loanable funds theory of interest. Despite these apparent differences and superiority of one over the other, there have been three attempts to prove that the two theories of the interest rate are two ways of looking at the same mechanism. Like the frugal horseman who bought only one spur because when one side of the horse went ahead, the other would follow. We could get along with only one of the approaches to the interest rate as pointed out by a supporter of these views of Hicks, Lerner, Fellner and Somers. Dr. Klein, who has critically analyzed these attempts at reconciliation of the two theories, comes to the conclusion that if only the two theories are explained in terms of stock analysis, that they will come to the same thing. Since the loanable funds version is a flow analysis of the interest rate determination, it cannot be reconciled with the liquidity preference theory. Note 3. L. R. Klein, The Keynesian Revolution, pages 118 to 120. Indeterminacy of the classical, the loanable funds and the Keynesian theories of interest. Keynes criticized the classical theory of interest for being indeterminate because it failed to relate the rate of interest with the income level. To Hansen, Keynes's criticism of the classical theory applies equally to his own theory and to the loanable funds theory. We illustrate the indeterminate nature of these theories. Page 261. In the classical formulation, since savings depend upon the level of income, it is not possible to know the rate of interest unless the income level is known beforehand. And the income level cannot be known without already knowing the rate of interest. A lower rate of interest will increase investment, output, employment, income and savings. So, for each income level, a separate supply curve will have to be drawn. The same reasoning applies to the loanable funds formulation of the rate of interest. The supply schedule of loanable funds is composed of savings, disholding, and bank money supply. Since savings vary with past income and the new money and activated balances with the current income, it follows that the total supply schedule of loanable funds also varies with income. Thus, this theory is indeterminate unless the income level is already known. The indeterminate nature of both the theories is explained in the figure 6. So in figure 6 we have saving and investment on the x-axis and rate of interest on the y-axis. There is the investment demand schedule II, which is a downward sloping straight line. Then there are two saving schedules for S1Y1 and S2Y2, such a way that S1Y1 is higher than S2Y2. Now S1Y1 and S2Y2 intersect II at points corresponding to which Q and Q1 are the points on the x-axis and R1 and R are the rates of interest. So R1 and Q are corresponding to the intersection between II and S1Y1. And R and Q1 correspond to the intersection between II and S2Y2. Returning to the text, all that the classical formulation gives us is a family of saving schedules and the loanable funds formulation a family of investment schedules at various income levels relating them to different interest rates. We take saving and investment or demand and supply of loanable funds on the x-axis and the rate of interest on the vertical axis. The saving schedules for both the formulations are shown as S1Y1 and S2Y2 and II is the investment schedule. When income is Y2, given the investment demand schedule and II and the saving schedule S2Y2, savings equal investment at interest rate R. Similarly, when income is Y1, the savings schedule S1Y1 equals the investment demand schedule II at interest rate R1. These equilibrium positions tell us about the various levels of income associated with different rates of interest, but not about the rate of interest itself. They show that interest is a function of savings, investment, and the level of income. Unless the level of income is known, it is not possible to determine the rate of interest. Hence, the classical and the loanable funds theories of interest rate are indeterminate. The Keynesian theory of interest rate is also indeterminate because the liquidity preference schedule is not related to the income level. Unless the income level is known beforehand, the demand and the supply curves of money cannot tell us what the rate of interest will be. All that the Keynesian formulation provides us is a family of liquidity preference schedules at various income levels, relating them to different interest rates. So in figure 7, a family of liquidity preference schedules LY, L1Y1 and L2Y2 are drawn at various income levels. So again in figure 7 we have amount of money on the x-axis, rate of interest on the y-axis. And as mentioned, LY, L1Y1 and L2Y2 are the liquidity preference schedules such that L1Y1 is higher than LY and L2Y2 is lower than LY. QM is parallel to the y-axis and QM intersects LY, corresponding interest rate is R. For corresponding interest rate for L1Y1 is R1 and for L2Y2 is R2. Returning to the text. A perfectly inelastic money supply curve QM is drawn on the assumption that the supply of money is fixed by the monetary authority. If Y is the income level, the liquidity preference schedule LY equals the money supply schedule QM at interest rate R. If the income level rises to Y1, the liquidity preference schedule also shifts upwards to L1M1 and equals QM curve at the interest rate R1. If the income falls to Y2 level, the liquidity preference curve shifts to L2Y2 and equals QM curve at the interest rate R2. Thus, the Keynesian theory simply relates different income levels to various interest rates, but does not show what the rate of interest will be. Hence, it is an indeterminate theory. Modern theory of interest. We have seen above that no single theory of interest rate is adequate and determinate. An adequate theory to be determinate must take into consideration both the real and the monetary factors that influence the interest rate. Hicks has utilized the Keynesian tools in a method of presentation which shows that productivity, thrift, liquidity preference, and money supply are all necessary elements in a comprehensive and determinate interest theory. According to Hansen, an equilibrium condition is reached when the desired volume of cash balances equals the quantity of money, when the marginal efficiency of capital is equal to the rate of interest, and finally, when the volume of investment is equal to the normal or desired volume of saving. And these factors are interrelated. Note 4. A. H. Hansen, Monetary Theory and Fiscal Policy, page 71. Page 262. Thus, in the modern theory of interest rate, saving, investment, liquidity preference, and the quantity of money are integrated at various levels of income for a synthesis of the loanable funds theory with the liquidity preference theory. The four variables of the two formulations have been combined to construct two new curves, the IS curve representing flow variable of the loanable funds formulation or the real factors of classical theory and the LM curve representing stock variables of liquidity preference formulation. The equilibrium between IS and LM curves provides a determinate solution. The IS curve. The IS curve has been derived from the loanable funds formulation. It is a curve which explains the relationship between a family of saving schedules and investment schedules. In other words, this curve shows the equality of saving and investment at various combinations of the levels of income and the rates of interest. In figure 8a, the saving curve S in relation to income is drawn in a fixed position, since the influence of interest on saving is assumed to be negligible. So in panel A of figure 8, we have income on the x-axis and saving and investment on the y-axis. We have a straight line curve S which is rising as we move from left to right. Then we have three different I curves, I1, I2 and I3, which are also rising as we move from left to right, but they start at points on the y-axis. I2 is higher than I1 and I3 is higher than I2. I1 is for R equal to 6%, I2 is for R equal to 5% and I3 is for R equal to 4%. Now, where S intersects I1, the point is E1 corresponding to income Y1. Where S intersects I2, the point is E2 corresponding to income Y2. And where S intersects I3, the point is E3 corresponding to income Y3. In figure 8, panel B, we have the IS curve, which is a curve which straight line which is dropping downwards as we move from left to the right. So corresponding to Y1, which is 100, Y2, which is 200 and Y3, which is equal to 300, there are three points on the IS curve, A, B and C. Corresponding to A, the interest rate is 6. Corresponding to B, the interest rate is 5. Corresponding to C, the interest rate is 4. So that is panel B of figure 8. Returning to the text. The saving curve shows that saving increases as income increases. That is, saving is an increasing function of income. Investment, on the other hand, depends on the rate of interest and the level of income. Given a level of interest rates, the level of investment rises with the level of income. At a 5% rate of interest, the investment curve is I2. If the rate of interest is reduced to 4%, the investment curve will shift upwards to I3. The rate of investment will have to be raised to reduce the marginal efficiency of capital to equality with the lower rate of interest. Thus, the investment curve I3 shows more investment at every level of income. Similarly, when the interest rate is raised to 6%, the investment curve will shift downward to I1. The reduction in the rate of investment is essential to raise the marginal efficiency of capital to equality with the higher interest rate. In figure 8b, just below figure 8a, we derive the IS curve by marking the level of income at various interest rates. Each point on this IS curve represents a level of income at which saving equals investment at various interest rates. The rate of interest is represented on the vertical axis and the level of income on the horizontal axis. If the rate of interest is 6%, the S curve intersects the I1 curve at E1, which determines OY1 income. From this income level, which equals rupees 100 crores, we draw a dashed line downward to intersect the extended line from 6% at point A. At interest rate 5%, the S curve intersects I2 curve at E2 so as to determine OY2 income, that is 200 crores. In the lower figure 8b, the point B corresponds to 5% interest rate and rupees 200 crores income level. Similarly, the point C corresponds to the equilibrium of S and I3 at 4% interest rate. By connecting these points A, B and C with a line, we get the IS curve. The IS curve slopes downwards from left to right because as the interest rate falls, investment increases and so does income. The LM curve. The LM curve shows all combinations of interest rates and levels of income at which the demand for and the supply of money are equal. The LM curve is derived from the Keynesian formulation of liquidity preference schedules and the schedule of supply of money. A family of liquidity preference curves L1Y1, L2Y2 and L3Y3 is drawn at income levels of rupees 100 crores. 200 crores and rupees 300 crores respectively in figure 9A. So I will explain the figure and continue with the text on the next page. Page 263. So in figure 9, panel A, we have demand and supply of money on the x-axis and interest rate on the y-axis. We have three LY curves, L1, Y1, L2, Y2 and L3, Y3, such that L1, Y1 is lowest, L2, Y2 is higher and L3, Y3 is higher than L2, Y2. Then we have the QM curve, which is a straight line parallel to the y-axis. The points where the Q curve meets the LY curves are E1, E2 and E3 respectively for interest rates R1, R2 and R3. This is for income Y1 which is 100, Y2 which is 200 and Y3 which is 300. So this is panel A of the figure 9. In panel B we have the LM curve which is a rising curve as we move from left to right, which then tends to become towards the end parallel to the y-axis. This is an LM curve. The points are K corresponding to Y1, S corresponding to Y2 and T corresponding to Y3, where K, S and T are for the rates R1, R2 and R3. So returning back to the text. The curves together with the perfectly inelastic money supply curve MQ give us the LM curve. The LM curve consists of a series of points, each point representing an interest income level at which the demand for money L equals the supply of money M. If the income level is Y1, that is 100 crores, the demand for money L1 Y1 equals the money supply QM at interest rate OR1. At Y2, that is rupees 200 crores income level, the L2, Y2 and QM curve equals at OR2 interest rate. Similarly, at Y3, that is rupees 300 crores income level, the L3, Y3 and QM curves equal at OR3 interest rate. The supply of money, the liquidity preference, the level of income and the rate of interest provide data for the LM curve shown in figure 9, panel B. Suppose the level of income is Y1 or 100 crores as marked out on the income axis of figure 9B. The income of rupees 100 crores generates a demand for money represented by the liquidity preference curve L1 Y1. From the point E1 where L1 Y1 curve intersects the MQ curve, extends a dashed line horizontally to the right so as to meet the line drawn upward from Y1 at K in figure 9B. Points S and T can also be determined in a similar manner. By connecting these points K, S and T with a line, we get the LM curve. This curve relates different income levels to various interest rates, but it does not show what the rate of interest will be. The LM curve slopes upwards from left to right because, given the quantity of money, an increasing preference for liquidity manifests itself in a higher rate of interest. It also becomes gradually perfectly inelastic, shown as the vertical portion from T above on the LM curve in panel B of figure 9. This is because at higher income levels, the demand for transaction and precautionary motives increases so that little is left to satisfy the demand for speculative motive out of a given supply of money. We may also note that at the extreme left, the LM curve is perfectly elastic in relation to the rate of interest. This is shown as the horizontal portion of the LM curve, which starts from the vertical axis in panel B of figure 9. With the decline in the level of income, the demand for transactions and precautionary motives also declines. Thus, a larger amount is available in the form of idle balances, but it does not lead to the lowering of the interest rate, because we have reached the limit to which the rate of interest will fall. This lower limit to which the rate of interest will fall is the Keynesian liquidity trap already explained above in Keynes' theory of interest. Determination of the rate of interest. The IS and LM curves relate to income levels and interest rates. Taken by themselves, they cannot tell us either about the level of income or the rate of interest. It is only their intersection that determines the rate of interest. This is illustrated in Figure 10, where the LM and IS curves intersect at point E, and the OR rate of interest is determined corresponding to the income level OY. So before we proceed, let me explain Figure 10. So we have income on the x-axis and interest rate on the y-axis. We have the two curves, IS curve and the LM curve, which we have generated in Figure 8 and 9. These two curves meet at point E. Corresponding to point E is rate of interest R and income is Y. There are other points marked, that is A and D on the LM curve, A corresponding to income Y1 and D corresponding to income Y2. DY2 meets IS at point C, which is at rate R2, and AY1 when extended to point B on IS curve corresponds to rate R1. Going back to the text. The income level and the interest rate lead to simultaneous equilibrium in the real, that is the saving investment market, and the money, that is the demand and supply of money market. This general equilibrium position persists at a point of time. If there is any deviation from this equilibrium position, certain forces will act and react in such a manner that the equilibrium will be restored. At the income level OY1, the rate of interest in the real market is Y1B and it is Y1A in the money market. When the former rate is higher than the latter, that is Y1B greater than Y1A, businessmen will borrow at a lower rate from the money market and invest the borrowed funds at a higher rate in the capital market. This will tend to raise the level of income to OY via the investment multiplier, and the equilibrium level of OR interest rate will be reached. On the other hand, at the income level OY2, the rate of interest in the real market is less than the interest rate in the money market, that is Y2C is less than Y2D. In this situation, businessmen will try to discharge debts in the money market rather than invest in the capital market. As a result, investment will fall and reduce income by the multiplier to OY, and equilibrium rate of interest OR will be established. Page 264. Shifts or changes in the IS curve or the LM curve or in both change the equilibrium position, and the rate of interest is determined accordingly. These are illustrated in Figure 11. So we have IS and LM, the original curves, in Figure 11, where income is on the x-axis and interest rate is on the y-axis. Then we have two other curves, LM1 and IS1, which are slightly shifted from the original curves towards the right. The point where LM and IS meet is E. The point where LM and IS1 meet is E1. The point where LM1 and IS1 meet is E2. Corresponding to E and E2, which are along the same horizontal axis, is the rate of interest R. Corresponding to E1 is the interest rate R1. E is for income Y, E1 is for income Y1, E2 is for income Y2. Returning to the text. So let IS and LM be the original curves. They intersect at E, where OR interest rate is determined at OY income level. If the investment demand schedule shifts upwards or the saving schedule shifts downwards, the curve IS would shift to the right as IS1 curve. Given the LM curve, equilibrium will take place at E1. The rate of interest would be OR1 and the income level OY1. If the quantity of money is increased or the liquidity preference curve is lowered, the LM curve would shift to the right as LM1. It intersects IS1 curve at point E2. The new equilibrium rate of interest is OR and the income level is OY2. Thus, with a given LM curve, when the IS curve shifts to the right, income increases and along with it the rate of interest also rises. Given the IS curve, when the LM curve shifts to the right, income increases but the rate of interest falls. The Hicks-Hansen analysis is thus an integrated and determinate theory of interest in which the two determinants, the IS and the LM curves, based on productivity, thrift, liquidity preference and the supply of money, all play their parts in the determination of the rate of interest. Its criticism. Despite its merits, the Hicks-Hansen theory of interest rate is not free from certain weaknesses. 1. Static theory. It is a static theory that explains the short-run behavior of the economy. Thus, it fails to explain how the economy behaves in the long run. 2. Interest rate not flexible. The theory is based on the assumption that the interest rate is flexible and varies with changes in LM and or IS curves. But it may not always happen if the interest rate happens to be rigid because the adjustment mechanism will not take place. 3. Investment not interest elastic. The theory assumes that investment is interest elastic, but if investment is interest inelastic, as is generally the case in practice, then the Hicks-Hansen theory does not hold good. 4. Highly artificial. According to Don Patinkin, the Hicks-Hansen theory is highly artificial and oversimplified because it divides the economy into real and monetary sectors. In reality, the real and monetary sectors of the economy are so interrelated and interdependent that they act and react on each other. 5. Closed model. According to Professor Rowan, the Hicks-Hansen theory is a closed model which does not take into consideration the effect of international trade. This restricts its usefulness for the study of policy problems. 6. Price level exogenous variable. The price level is treated as an exogenous variable in this model. This is unrealistic because price changes play an important role in the determination of income and interest rates in an economy. Despite these weaknesses, this theory does not undermine the utility of the ISLM technique in explaining the determination of interest rate in an economy. Natural and market rate of interest. The Wicksell theory. Nutt Wicksell, Nutt is K-N-U-T. Note 5. Nutt Wicksell, Interest and Prices, A Study of the Causes Regulating the Value of Money, 1898, and Lectures of Political Economy, Volume 2, 1906, both translated from Swedish, the former by R. F. Kahn, 1936, and the latter by E. Klassen, 1935. So Nutt Wicksell was the first economist to discuss in detail the relation between a natural interest rate and market interest rate. In his book, Interest and Prices, he uses such phrases as ordinary rate, the normal rate, and the real rate as synonyms for the natural rate. Page 265. He defined it in these words. The rate of interest at which the demand for loan capital and the supply of savings exactly agree, and which more or less corresponds to the expected yield on the newly created capital, will then be the normal or the natural real rate. It is the rate consistent with a stable money supply and stable prices. On the other hand, the market rate of interest is the money rate prevailing in the loan market. It is the rate of interest charged by banks or lenders. It depends upon the demand and supply of money. Assumptions. The Wicksell theory is based on the following assumptions. 1. There is full employment in the economy. 2. Investment is a decreasing function of the rate of interest. 3. Saving is an increasing function of the rate of interest. Explanation. According to Wicksell, the natural rate is essentially variable. It is partly determined by the demand for loans, which in turn depends on the expected profitability of new investment. All factors which affect the expected profitability of investment bring changes in the natural rate of interest. There are changes in the productive efficiency or technical progress, changes in domestic and foreign demand, changes in the supply of capital, labor and land, etc. But in order to ensure a constant supply of savings, which is the second determinant of the natural rate of interest, the natural rate would have to be the same in all enterprises and in all uses, with the ratio for future land to present land equal to the ratio of future labor to present labor. Any shift in these relationships would change the value of capital and alter the connection between capital goods industries and consumer goods industries. Wixell points out that the natural rate is not the same as the market rate. There are disparities between the two rates during the short run which produce changes in the price level. The market rate of interest tends to be sticky and responds slowly to changes in the demand for loanable funds. In the long run, disparities between the two rates automatically generate forces which bring their equality. According to Wixell, the natural rate diverges from the market rate when the economy is in disequilibrium. As a result, a cumulative process is created whereby discrepancy emerges between the cost of borrowing capital and expected profitability of new investment. A cumulative process is a disequilibrium situation in which net investment is positive and is constantly increasing from period to period. This happens when the market rate is lower than the natural rate. This is shown in figure 12, where I is the investment demand curve or the demand curve for loans and S is the supply curve of savings or loanable funds. So we have figure 12 in which saving and investment is on the x-axis and rate of interest is on the y-axis. There are two curves, the investment curve, which is a downward sloping curve, so it falls as we move towards the right, and the supply curve S, which is an increasing curve, so it increases as we move towards the right. They intersect at point E, corresponding to which rate is small r and investment is Q. There is another point R1 less than R. Corresponding to R1 is point A on the S curve and B on the I curve. Returning to the text. Suppose R is the natural rate of interest and R1 the market rate of interest. Thus, at the market rate of interest R1, the investment demand or the demand for loans exceeds the supply of savings by AB. It means that bank loans expand and funds are used to increase the demand for investment goods. As a result, the total demand for money exceeds the available supply of money. In a situation of full employment, this raises the demand for goods and services, thereby increasing prices. This increased demand for money in turn raises the market rate of interest. With the rise in the market rate of interest, money incomes expand and transactions demand for money increases, which reduces the available supply of money for lending purposes. Assuming no further increase in money supply, the money rate of interest comes into equality with the natural rate of interest at point E in figure 12. On the contrary, if the money rate of interest is higher than the natural rate, the demand for bank loan falls, bringing down the market rate of interest till it equals the natural rate. According to Wixell, the cumulative process of disequilibrium may also be caused by increase in the demand for loans due to innovations and technical progress, which raise the expected profitability of new investment. Page 266. This is illustrated in figure 13. So in figure 13, we have saving and investment on the x-axis, rate of interest on the y-axis. Similar to the previous figure, we have one S curve and one I curve which intersect at point E. There is another I1 curve which is higher than the I curve, and I1 and S intersect at point E1. Corresponding to E, the rate of interest is R. Corresponding to E1 is the rate of interest R1. Saving and investment corresponding to E is Q, and corresponding to the rate R, there is point A on I1 and savings is Q1. So returning to the text, the initial monetary equilibrium is shown by the equality of S and I curves at point E, where both the natural and the market rates are equal at R interest rate. The increased demand for loans is shown by shifting of the investment demand curve upwards from I to I1. This causes the natural rate to rise to R1 when S and I1 curves intersect at E1. If the monetary authority does not raise the market rate R to the level of the natural rate R1, the banks increase their lendings at the market rate of interest R. The increased monetary demand will raise prices. As prices rise, aggregate demand would increase along the horizontal axis at the market rate R. In terms of figure 13, at the market rate R, the supply of loans by banks is OQ, which is equal to small RE. And with the increase in the demand for investment funds to I1, banks increase the money supply by QQ1, which is equal to EA. Thus, the horizontal line EA is a perfectly elastic supply curve which equals I1 curve at A, and the increased investment demand is met by QQ1 loans from the bank. With the increase in money supply, the demand for capital goods rises, which in turn raises the demand for goods and services and consequently raises their prices. This process of money expansion and inflationary rise in price will ultimately raise the market rate R to the level of the natural rate of interest R1. In Wicksell's analysis, business fluctuations are traced to the divergence between natural and market rates of interest. Expansion in the economy takes place when the natural rate is above the market rate and vice versa. In the cumulative process of upward or downward change, expansions and contractions of bank credit play a crucial role. The cumulative process comes to an end when the two rates are brought into equality. But prices would not be restored to the original level. Yet, there would be a new equilibrium for the economy where the market rate equals the natural rate. A critical appraisal. Wicksell integrated interest theory, quantity theory, aggregate demand and aggregate supply, and the functioning of a modern banking system. He thus anticipated some of the current notions in monetary theory. Wicksell stated three conditions in his theory. First, the equality between the natural, that is equilibrium rate, and the market or the bank rate. Second, the equality of X ante-saving and investment. Third, a constant price level. These identical conditions have come to be known as monetary equilibrium in modern monetary analysis. It was Wicksell who attributed changes in the price level to discrepancies between aggregate demand and aggregate supply on the basis of relationship between saving and investment. In this way, he formulated an income approach to the problem of money and prices, which contained the embryo of a theory of output as a whole, according to Ohlin. It was again Wicksell who stressed the importance of the rate of interest in monetary theory. By concentrating upon the rate of interest, writes Professor Hansen, he swept away the narrow foundations of the quantity theory. Note 6. A. H. Hansen, Monetary Theory and Fiscal Policy, page 71. Further, Wicksell integrated monetary and non-monetary theories of interest by emphasizing the equilibrium of natural interest rate and market interest rate. He thus paved the way for a determinate theory of interest as developed by Hicks and Hansen, which is regarded as the modern theory of interest. Again, Wicksell's cumulative process has come to be known as the Wicksell effect. It emphasizes the importance of bank credit creation on the rate of interest. Mrs. Robinson regards the Wicksell effect as the key to the whole theory of capital accumulation. Moreover, Wicksell was a quantity theorist who wanted to arrive at a theory which should be both self-consistent and in full agreement with facts. His analysis of the link between the banking system and short-run inflations during the cumulative process is to be found in the hyperinflation case studies in Friedman's studies in the quantity theory of money. Similarly, the suppressed inflation that followed the post-war years 1945-51 due to the policies adopted by monetary authorities in the USA may also be attributed to the Wicksellian cumulative process. Thus, Wicksell was the forerunner of the modern monetary theorists. Page 267. Its defects. But he is not free from critics who have pointed out certain defects in his theory. 1. According to Professor Ackley, Wicksell's analysis differed from the simple quantity theory only in the process by which its results were achieved, not in its results. In equilibrium, prices were proportional to the money supply and both were constant in time. In equilibrium, there were no idle balances flowing into the capital market, nor additions needing to be made to cash balances in order to finance a larger volume of money transactions. Note 7, G. Ackley, opposite, page 161. Thus, Wicksell thought of only transactions and precautionary motives, neglected the speculative motive to hold money. 2. Moreover, his work falls short of an adequate theory of income determination. It related to one determinant of income, the investment function, according to Hansen. Note 8. A.H. Hansen, opposite, page 89. 3. Hansen further points out that the multiplier analysis based on the consumption function was missing. There is, moreover, implicit in much of Wicksell's work an excessively optimistic view with respect to the interest elasticity of investment, and he saw very dimly the relation of the demand for cash holdings to the rate of interest. He failed to see that in certain situations the investment function may be interest inelastic, while the liquidity preference function may be highly interest elastic. Wicksell did not clearly understand the conditions under which interest rate policy becomes futile. Accordingly, he enormously exaggerated the power of the banking system to control, by rate implications, the flow of aggregate demand and the level of prices. Note 9, IBID, page 93. Fisher's analysis. In modern analysis, the real or natural rate of interest refers to the percentage rate paid on borrowed money after making an adjustment for changes in the price level. On the other hand, the market or money rate of interest is the percentage rate paid on borrowed money. If a person borrows rupees 10,000 from a bank at 6%, it is the money rate of interest. He will have to return 10,600. That is rupees 10,000 plus rupees 600 as interest charges to the bank after a year. If, however, during this period the price index rises by 1.02, the real rate of interest is reduced. In order to find out the real rate of interest, the sum repaid to the bank is deflated by the price index. That is, rupees 10,600 divided by 1.02, which is equal to rupees 10,392. It implies that the bank has earned 3.92% as real interest, as against the money rate of 6% per annum. If the price index falls, a given money rate of interest will imply a higher real rate of interest. Following Marshall, Fisher enunciated the proposition that the money rate of interest is equal to the real rate of interest plus the rate of change in the price level. Suppose prices are falling at 5% per annum. A zero money rate of interest in this case implies a real rate of 5%. To quote Marshall, a money rate of 5% per annum corresponds to a real rate of 15.5% when prices are falling at 10% per annum. That is, the purchasing power of $105 at the beginning of the year is equivalent to that of $115.50 at the end of the year. Similarly, a money rate of 5% corresponds to a negative real rate of 5.5% when the annual rate at which prices are rising is 10%. In case the price level is constant, the money rate equals the real rate of interest. To take our previous example, let the money rate of interest and the real rate of interest be 6% with a constant price level. Suppose with a rise in the price level by 2%, the real rate of interest falls to 4%, equivalent to the rise in the price level. There is, however, no change in the money rate due to the money illusion or institutional rigidity in the money market. Page 268. Given the marginal efficiency of investment, a fall in the real rate of interest will encourage investment and vice versa. This is illustrated in figure 14. Money and real interest rate are taken on the vertical axis along with the marginal efficiency of investment. The amount of investment is shown on the horizontal axis. MEI is the curve of marginal efficiency of investment. With a constant price level, MR represents money as well as the real rate of interest, which is 6% per annum. At this rate, OI investment is taking place. With the rise in the price level by 2%, there is an equivalent fall in the real rate as depicted by the new interest line R1, R2 at 4% interest rate. Now, the MR line represents only the money rate of 6%. A fall in the real rate of interest has tended to encourage investment from OI to OI1. Converse is true when the price level falls. Exercises. Question 1. Discuss the role of real forces of thrift and productivity in determination of the rate of interest. 2. In what respects is the loanable funds theory of interest an improvement on the classical theory? 3. Interest theory has been confused by a failure to distinguish clearly between the money rate and the natural rate of interest. Discuss. 4. Critically discuss the Keynesian theory of liquidity preference as an explanation of the determination of the interest rate. 5. Compare the classical and the Keynesian theories of the rate of interest. 6. How are rate of interest and national income determined simultaneously in an economy? 7. Explain the Hicks-Hansen reconciliation of the stock and flow theories of interest rate. 8. Discuss Wicksell's theory of interest rates. 9. Write a note on Fisher's theory of real and market rate of interest. With this, we come to the end of chapter 33.